And I told Peter I wouldn't embarrass him with an introduction. But I think I'm going to hold to it because he's looking at me really, really seriously. So Peter Anastas is going to get the night started, and we're excited to have him here with Bob Buckeye.
Thanks very much. Thank you for coming. I'm going to read first, and then I'm going to introduce Bob Buckeye, who will read, and then we're going to talk a little bit afterwards about the writers and books that have brought us to where we are today. Just let me know if at any point you can't hear me. I'm going to read two sections from the memoir that I have just completed. It's a sequel to my previous memoir, At the Cut, and it is called From Gloucester Out. And I'm going to read from a section that I call Bowden Beata. And I'm using that term from a college song. And you will see as I read that I'm using it ironically. Bowden Beata, our dear alma mater. There is no fairer mother neath the sun. Everything changed when Rooney Reardon appeared on campus. Hunched bear-like over the dinner table at the TD house, he didn't resemble the other brothers with their starched Oxford cloth shirts and filtered cigarettes, hair neatly trimmed into brush cuts. Rooney wore a faded plaid Pendleton shirt and baggy brown corduroy pants, even though it was a mild September day. His feet were clad in hunting boots, while his face was obscured by a thick red beard, blue eyes peering out of steel-rimmed spectacles. Rooney was a Korean War veteran, returning to college on the GI Bill. He had transferred to Bowdoin from NYU. Like me, he was an English major. He sat with nonchalance, chain-smoking Lucky Strikes and downing one cup of black coffee after another. His voice was gravelly, and he spoke with a thick New York accent. After his wide-eyed audience had returned to the bridge table, Rooney and I lingered over coffee, talking far into the afternoon. He'd read all the books I read, and he traveled to places in Europe and Asia I had only dreamed of visiting. Rooney had also survived a particularly brutal war, one that sent him home unwounded physically, but utterly cynical about the human condition. It was the beginning of my junior year. After meeting Rooney, nothing would be the same again. For the past 2 years, I had lived in a dormitory surrounded by students who studied all week and guzzled beer during the weekend. I attended class, spent hours over coffee in the student union or in late-night bull sessions. By that time, several of my friends had either dropped out of college or transferred to Berkeley or Reed. Tired of dormitory living, my roommate from sophomore year, John Swierczynski, and I rented an attic room off campus, hung with bullfight posters and Van Gogh prints, and virtually heatless in winter, it became our refuge from college life. The sound of heavy footsteps on the wooden stairs that led to our garret, followed by pounding on the door, announced Rooney's habitual arrival for late-night talks that often lasted far into the night. No walker, even though he'd grown up on the streets of Manhattan, Rooney always drove his maroon 55 Cadillac from the TD house over to our place on Green Street, accompanied by a six-pack of beer or a fifth of Old Crow. He'd lower himself into our solitary easy chair, light his first Lucky, and begin excitedly to tell us about the book he'd just put down or the UFOs he'd encountered flashing across the sky the night before. Rooney didn't sound like a student or anyone I'd ever heard, except for the jazz musicians my brother and I had met. He referred to everyone as man, and when he greeted you, he'd nod, "I'm hip," and when he agreed with you, he'd nod, "I'm hip," or "I hear you." Rooney approached everything with an intensity that stunned the usually unfazable upperclassman in the fraternity. But even with his heavy drinking and profanity, he was popular. He was assigned one of the few single rooms in the house and elevated to brotherhood without being hazed, though I couldn't imagine any of those who had once abused us standing up to Rooney's truculence. As soon as I'd introduced him to my friend Peter Denzer, who managed Brunswick's only bookstore, Rooney spent most afternoons in front of the shop's roaring fireplace, talking politics with Peter or reading his way through Atlas Shrugged. A World War II veteran and former foreign correspondent, Peter had moved to Brunswick from New York with his painter wife, Anne, and their two children. He and Rooney hit it off immediately. Rooney admired the fact that Peter had published three novels, and Peter found in Rooney a student far more serious than the most of the fraternity brothers who wandered into the store searching for copies of Marjorie Morningstar. If you don't get that, that was a bestseller in the 50s. There were sex scenes in it. This is the sickest country in the world, Rooney would abruptly begin one of their conversations. Where else would you knock a guy who walked into Howard Johnson's wearing a beard? I mean, what is so threatening about facial hair? That's not what red-blooded American males are supposed to look like, Peter replied, sporting a beard himself. Then they didn't bark on a series of exchanges during which Slippery Dick Nixon and that baby-faced piece of shit, Eisenhower, were excoriated, along with complete sellouts like Herman Wouk and Sloan Wilson, more best-selling novelists of the 50s. We had all devoured On the Road as soon as it was published that fall. While Peter, who'd known Jack Kerouac in the Village, thought the narrative compelling but formless, Rooney and I were impressed by its spontaneity. If you're seeking spontaneity, Peter insisted, read Henry Miller or Céline. At least their books have some complexity. But there's complexity in the here and now, Rooney rejoined. That incident in San Francisco Bar, where the tenement leaps down from the bandstand and starts wailing with the crowd yelling and clapping all around him, transcends the immediacy of the scene. Kerouac isn't just describing what it's like to listen to a great jazz musician improvise. He's talking about ecstasy. I'll grant you that, Peter shook his head, returning to the cash register to complete a sale to a faculty wife, shocked to encounter three bearded men shouting excitedly at each other in a smoke-filled room. There was no question about Rooney's being a compulsive reader and a brilliant talker in class. From the beginning, he impressed Herbie Brown, the English department chair, with his grasp of Shakespeare. And in our contemporary literature class, Rooney and the professor, novelist Larry Hall, would argue about the respective merits of Henri Barbusse's Under Fire and A Farewell to Arms, while the rest of us sat there with our mouths open. But there was another side to Rooney. He was an avid hunter who owned a number of guns. Though I had never fired a weapon, except during ROTC training in high school, I'd grown up around people who hunted regularly. And once I started living in Maine, where practically everyone was a crack shot, including women, I never questioned the practice. As soon as the fall season was announced, Peter and Rooney went deer hunting. During chilly dawns, they also stalked ducks and geese in the nearby coastal marshes. Rooney possessed a hunting rifle and several small arms, including a .357 Magnum pistol he often took into the woods with him for target practice. Peter and I weren't invited on those excursions. It was clear that Rooney, ever more restless, wanted to be alone. As the weeks passed and the brilliant fall gave way to gray November, Rooney became morose. Drinking heavily, he slept until noon, skipping classes and lurching down the stairs to lunch with a hangover. In the short time I knew him, I never observed him studying. I suspected that he got by on a lifetime of reading. And he wrote the way he talked, with a colloquial ease and unfailing critical insight. His professor seemed dazzled by the papers he turned in, each one composed directly on the typewriter a few hours before it was due. One night, We were all at the Densers, comfortable apartment at the mill end of Main Street, eating Annie's fabulous pastel sugo, which Peter knows all about, and home-baked bread washed down with Italian wine they brought back from trips to New York. The kids were in bed, and Annie was strumming softly on her guitar, singing Josh White songs. Talked turned to the future, as Peter asked Rooney and me what we were planning to do after we graduated. "I don't believe in the future," Rooney replied flatly. "It's another illusion, forcing people out of their present concerns while governments start wars and corporations rob us blind." "But you two guys will have had an envious education," Peter pressed. "How will you use it for the good of society?" "How will society use us for its own good?" Rooney shot back. "Then you'll do nothing," Peter asked. "Or will you become perennial students?" He looked at me. "You know I want to teach," I said. "Teaching will squeeze the writing out of you," Rooney declared. "Look at these professors here struggling for years to finish a book in order to keep their jobs. I see them rushing across the quad late to class, their houses full of kids, overeducated wives changing diapers with one hand and reading Kingsley Amos with the other." "Isn't that what life comes down to?" Peter asked. "If you choose to marry, children are pretty much inevitable." "Ah, that's a bourgeois delusion," Rooney said. "Once you're caught in a trap, you begin to buy on credit, and after they got you in debt, you're in prison for life." "Marriage doesn't have to be a trap," Annie looked up brightly. "Peter and I are living pretty much out of the mainstream." "I quit the city, too," Rooney said, a reflective look crossing his quickly reddening face. "My dream was to hide myself away in a monastic institution where I could study and read, maybe even start work on the novel about Korea that's been hounding me. But after I got here, present company accepted, all I saw were these snot-nosed preppies tossing water balloons out of dormitory windows and passing out in their dates' laps. Is that what college is all about?" I asked myself. "Did I and my buddies fight a war to free the world from totalitarianism so these shitheads could step in and run it?" A couple of weeks later, there was an early winter house party. By then, the streets were lined with snowdrifts, and we walked to class in Arctic parkas, hoods pulled tightly around our ears, our breath drifting behind us like cigarette smoke on the icy air. The campus was awash with dates who'd arrived by car and train from Smith and Bryn Mawr. You could hear the shrill cries of girls in mink coats and striped scarves as couples rushed from house to house, laughing, drinking, kissing under snow-covered pines. My girlfriend Leslie had begged off due to exams. Feeling abandoned, I resolved to hit the books myself, avoiding the house except for meals. I ran into Rooney on Friday night at dinner and again at lunch on Saturday. It was clear he was drinking. He didn't say much, except for complaining about having to listen while one of the brothers in the room next to his was getting head from a date. I was in a hurry anyway. John had hitchhiked home to South Portland, and finally I had the room to myself. But my study time was short-lived. Late Saturday afternoon, my trumpeter friend, Ron Kerwood, knocked on the door to ask if I'd fill in on piano with his band that night at the Zeta House. It turned out to be a wild party. Halfway through the gig, a gang of brothers and their dates barged into the lounge where we were playing. "Some nut took a gun and blew a hole in the wall at the TD house," they shouted, breaking up the dance. With the Zeta party shut down, I rushed across the campus to the TD house. A member of the Brunswick police force stood blocking the entrance. Looking through the window, I could see policemen and campus security guards who appeared to be comforting the dates. I trudged in the snow back to the student union, where a couple of TD brothers and their girlfriends were sobering up with black coffee. "It was Rooney," one of the upperclassmen, Mark Smith, reported, shaking his head. "He'd been boozing all weekend." At one point, Rooney had apparently staggered into the living room, wearing a brown tweed suit. The place was packed with brothers and their dates. Everyone thought he was coming to join the party. Instead, he reached under his jacket, whipped out the Magnum pistol, and fired a shot into the wall near the fireplace. According to Mark, an enormous hole opened up, and you could smell smoke and gunpowder everywhere. The dates started screaming, and those who could took cover behind the couches. When the police arrived, Rooney was standing alone in the center of the room, the gun still in his hand. On Monday, I went to the hearing in Portland. Rooney stood in front of the judge wearing the same dark tweed suit he'd worn at the house the night of the incident. He'd been expelled from Bowdoin. Considering that he had fought valiantly in Korea, the college agreed to drop criminal charges if Rooney would vacate his room and leave the campus immediately. He was required to pay for the damage at the house. His weapons had also been confiscated. We shook hands outside the courthouse on Congress Street. Rooney's Cadillac was parked nearby, loaded with his possessions. "I'll miss you," I said. "I thought things would be different in Brunswick," Rooney said. "But I didn't have any room to move. Why do you suppose I blew a hole in the wall at the house? Not because I was drunk, which I was, because I felt imprisoned." He paused, shaking his head. "I also wanted to teach those little pricks a lesson about reality." Later in the spring, Rooney wrote me that he was back in New York, sharing an apartment in the Village with an old Army buddy. They were taking courses at the new school. Come summer, they planned to leave for San Francisco, driving straight across the country in the maroon Cadillac. With Rooney gone, I quit the fraternity. That's the first piece. Thank you. This next piece is a sequel in a different mode. It's called Interlude, 83 Frederick Street. It's short, and it begins with a quotation from Nathaniel Hawthorne, who graduated from Bowdoin. "I did not submit myself to her intellectual discipline during my college years so faithfully as I ought, but endeavored rather to find out modes of culture for myself, and often went astray in search of them." Ever since high school, I had felt the need for a room of my own, though I didn't fully attain my dream until senior year in college, when I finally had a place entirely to myself at 83 Federal Street in a big white 19th century house occupied by the chairman of the biology department. My furnished single room was located over an L attached to the main structure. It had a private bathroom and a separate entrance, accessed from a walkway off Federal Street next door to the mansion where the president of the college lived. Because my room was in an isolated wing, I was undisturbed by the radios or record players of those students who lived in the house with Professor Gustafson and his family. Once I lighted the floor lamp behind the easy chair at the foot of my bed, and the room was suffused with a comforting yellow glow. Then after returning at midnight from my work shift at the library, I put on my flannel bathrobe, wrap a blanket around me, keeping myself warm that way I could study or read for as long as I wished, often until the first light. Usually I slept until noon because I no longer had morning classes. I took breakfast and lunch together at the student union, eating alone or with a small group of students who, like me, had either quit or never joined a fraternity. To the right of my old upholstered chair was a dark, polished bookcase with glass doors. It was there I kept the books I owned, the poetry of Pound and Williams, and some paperback editions of the novels I was currently reading, Women in Love, Aaron's Rod, Celine's Journey to the End of Night. The floor against the adjacent wall was lined with books borrowed from the library. To the left of the lone door to my room was my desk. Over it, I tacked a street map of Florence, cut out of a Baedeker guide I'd found at a church book sale. Between my desk and single bed was a window and another at the foot of the bed and to the right of the closet. Over my bed, I had a Vlaming print of fishing vessels tied to a wharf in Normandy because its murky browns and cerulean blues reminded me of the waterfront in Gloucester. A faded oriental rug covered most of the floor. Between an antique dresser and the bookcase, a hi-fi console sat on a table with cast iron legs. My collection of 10 and 12-inch long-playing jazz albums was lined up under it. Attached to the dresser was a mirror that reflected my desk and the map of Florence, which in the yellow light appeared to be made of old parchment. This was the room I had lived in since September of 1958. A solitary floor duct heated it irregularly. The sound of trailer trucks late at night on the Bath Road connected me to the commerce of highways, while the roar of jet planes taking off from the Brunswick Naval Air Station, a mile from the campus, was a constant reminder that I was never very far from the instruments of war or those who operated them. Though I had friends on campus with whom I enjoyed talking or listening to music, I gradually separated myself from college life. After class, I stopped in at the bookstore to resume the conversation Peter Denzer and I had broken off the previous day. Once a week, Peter invited me home for dinner, and sometimes I'd babysit for their two sons, Pete and Kiko, so Peter and Annie could enjoy one of their rare evenings out. But it was in this room, the first I had occupied without a roommate, that I committed myself to the practice of reading and writing I would pursue for the rest of my life. D.H. Lawrence was among the writers I began to read systematically during that final year. Lawrence, the working-class intellectual who was alienated from his own class and from the culture he grew up in, along with a literary society that should have provided a sustaining environment, attracted me. Not only as a writer, but in the way he lived restlessly, moving from Nottinghamshire to Germany, from Italy to Ceylon, Australia, the American Southwest, ultimately dying in the south of France. The Lawrence who also intrigued me was the Lawrence who wrote, "At times one is forced essentially to be a hermit," adding, "Yet here I am nowhere, as it were, and infinitely an outsider." My deep study of Lawrence prepared me for the senior thesis I was expected to submit as part of the graduation requirement for an English major. I chose to write mine on the Plumed Serpent, not one of Lawrence's most successful or highly acclaimed novels, but one which drew me because of its mythic qualities and because it was set in exotic Mexico. There were many teachers at Bowdoin to whom I am indebted, but the principal education I received in college was not in the classroom, nor was it at the hands of my fellow students, whom I had increasingly little to do with, except for a small group of friends who were actors and writers. My true education emanated from the Hawthorne Longfellow Library, where for 4 years I read widely on my own, irrespective of course syllabi or graduation requirements, especially during my final 2 years when I worked nights at the circulation desk, studying in the library and familiarizing myself with its immense holdings. Each night after work, I would return to my room with a new book, which I would read often until dawn. The books gradually piled up around my desk. Edward Nell's three-volume biography of Lawrence, Herman Brock's The Death of Virgil. And I read and read, circling around schools, eras, places, cultures, until I had created for myself a better picture of the birth of European modernism than I would ever have received had I taken a course in this subject, which wasn't offered anyway. The fiction I was writing at the time, stories about growing up in Gloucester, didn't directly incorporate this reading, but the reading inspired it, particularly Robert Musil's electrifying coming-of-age novel, The Confusions of Young Turles. Mostly, I wrote about what I was reading in a journal that I began to keep inspired by André Gide's journals, and in daily letters to my girlfriend Leslie, who was studying literature at Boston University. As I reflect on the books I read in those intense months in that single room on Federal Street in Brunswick, Maine, while my classmates were dating girls, drinking beer, and planning the careers that would eventually bring them more money than I would ever earn in a lifetime of reading and writing, I wonder if my life has changed appreciably 60 years later. Am I any different now from that bearded boy in the old bathroom, reading in a fraying chair under the glow of a rickety floral lamp, on the corner of the Bath Road, as trailer trucks roared by in the night and jet fighter planes took off at dawn, while I was falling asleep, my head full of images from the books I'd read myself to sleep over? What I'm speaking of is not simply the books I devoured and the room I read them in. It's about an education that would not have been possible without the library that contained those books and the room in which to read them. After 3 stumbling years, I had found my own refuge, and that sanctuary, if even for 1 year alone, constituted the most important aspect of my undergraduate experience. It established a pattern I would follow for the rest of my life, which you might say has been a life spent in secluded rooms of old houses, reading and writing. I attended class during that time I'm describing, reading Sophocles and Dante, immersing myself in romantic poetry and ancient history. I had a girlfriend. I went to parties, though I spent most of my time playing piano at them and in other venues around Brunswick. but my room at 83 Federal Street was my sanctuary. I studied with teachers who made a profound impression on me, opening me to the richness of their own minds, as well as to disciplines I might never have been able to master on my own. But at bottom, and certainly due to their guidance, I have essentially become my own teacher. I've lived and written in other rooms, but the one I'm drawn back to is that room on Federal Street, where it all began, and where I often feel it was better than in any other room or in any other time or place in my life. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm now going to introduce the next reader, Robert Buckeye, Bob Buckeye. At the center of Bob Buckeye's clear, direct prose is moral memory, our mutual friend Ken Warren has written. All his life, from Cleveland to Vieques, he has been measuring the material world from the body out. It is this rare combination of moral memory and materialism that makes Buckeye's writing so compelling. I met Bob Buckeye through Ken Warren, editor of Vincent Farini's Selected Poems and publisher of House Organ, one of the seminal literary journals of our era. Bob reviewed My Broken Trip for Ken, a review that saw deeper into the book than I myself had while writing it. We began corresponding, but did not meet until the 2010 Olson Centenary celebration in Worcester, and not again face-to-face until today, though we have emailed each other daily. Corresponding with Bob and reading each of his books, his unsurpassed novel of Edvard Munch's ordeal, The Munch Case, his narrative of the Detroit riot, his extraordinary novella about the psychoanalysis of Trotsky's daughter, not her nor him, his examination of the life of the infamous Countess Elizabeth Bathory, his major study of the life and work of British avant-garde novelist Anne Quinn, published by Dalkey Archive Press, as well as works set in places such as Puerto Rico, Bratislava, and Montreal. It's been an education for me, not to speak of all the Eastern European writers Bob has introduced me to, whose work has inspired my own. Bob is both a critic of film and writing and a writer of fiction, as well as having produced a series of chapbooks about forgotten Vermont history. It has always seemed to me that his fiction embodies the rigor of his criticism, while his criticism, recently collected in a wonderful volume, Living In, while his criticism has the dramatic impact of his fiction. Bob has also written major biographical and critical studies of Meredith Lesser, Nathan Ashe, Alfred Hayes, and most recently Joe Sinclair for the Contemporary Authors series. As you will experience tonight, Bob seeks in his writing to reclaim what is at the point of disappearance. Less a digging down, the work of archaeologists or historians, than a series of collisions with people, places, encounters. For many years, Bob has been spending part of each year in Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia. One of the fruits of those stays is his novel Fade, from which he will be reading tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Bob Buckeye, whose visit to the Gloucester Writers' Center has long overdue. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Oh. Thank you, Peter, for that quite generous introduction. It's part of the talk that Peter and I have all the time in terms of what we say in emails and how we read one another's writing. This is the first two sections of the novel Fade, which takes place in Bratislava, Slovakia. They never lose you. The they that never loses anyone, the they that keeps me on the road, day after day, following those who disappeared down the street until one day I joined them. 6 times in the last 5 years. Not escape as an end game, absence as possibility. A way to hold on to a past that might never have happened. The mysteries of a life whose evidence won't let me go. A somewhere else that would not be forgotten or forgiven, but could not be denied. Every day, the scene on the street is the same, though the people change. Tourists pass through Starry Mesto, the old town, in a steady stream, but also those I think I've seen before. Men in suits with cell phones, deals going down as they pass by, neighborhoods bought and sold. Women in tight jeans and low-cut blouses, meeting brokers, industry reps. You distinguish them from tourists by how fast they walk, more than by how they dress. There are no Starbabas in the old town, old crones in pitch-black dresses and babushkas who shuffle along. A tour guide pauses, waits for the straggling group to come up to her before she points to the Mozart residence down a few steps on Ventushka. They look Slavic, and as always with tour groups, with the exception of Japanese, are old, halting, infirm. For the most part, those who come to Bratislava come from Eastern Europe because they can't afford Paris or London. Those who come from the West seek out their past, the erotic oriental mysteries of Middle Europa, the end of the road. Yesterday, I saw her turn her head away from the group she led and for a moment frown, pass a hand over her forehead. Tomorrow, she might be gone. Slovaks earn a quarter of what Austrians do. Last year, thousands of nurses left Slovakia for the West. In Florida restaurants, waitresses come from Russia, Poland, the Ukraine. In a restaurant a friend owns in Vermont, Moldovans. The road waits. The road always waits. Some men ride on such space, Charles Olson says, but they ride on it less than it rides them. Mile after mile, the road writing itself on them, saying what they cannot say, a tattooing that cannot be erased. They have been undone. Unrelieved, Olson says, of Billy the Kid. In Detroit, there had been Malcolm X, the Algiers Motel, the door of a prison cell closing behind me. In San Juan, just before dawn, an out-of-the-way calle in the Condado. In Indiana, at a farmhouse, the corn harvested, a sparrow hawk floating above, mice racing for safety. Malcolm had been electric. Democracy was a lie, he said, matter-of-factly, as if we all knew that, equality a myth. If we did not do something, Malcolm paused, and the question hung in the air. There was a storm coming. My waitress approaches, her attention caught by something over my shoulder, the hint of a smile on her face, her forehead lined and wrinkled. Today she is wearing a dark auburn jersey, not the pale blue T-shirt she wore the last 4 days. She is young, with silken brown hair pulled back into a bun, a turned-up nose with an inflamed reddish pimple at one nostril. She does not smile, and her hazel-gray almond eyes are always blank. Elisabetta, she said when I asked her name last week. She kept her gaze on my forehead. She was leaving Slovakia. I asked her why America. For a moment, she put a hand on her hip and looked at me as if I understood nothing. Someone is speaking English at the next table. An older man in a baggy gray sport coat talking on a cell phone. His hair is white, thick, carefully styled, and his face beet red, perspiring. Across from him, a much younger, fleshy woman, her cheeks flushed as if she is out of breath, runs a finger across the rim of her coffee cup and looks at the man with concern. "We need to be tough," he says. The woman reaches across the table and takes his hand in hers. "The students might be a problem," he adds. "We can take care of them." His smile, smug reassurance. Tap. His spoon against his coffee cup. Tap, tap. I hear another voice, and I hear it as clearly as I heard it out of the babble, a brilliant, sun-drenched afternoon. The police came on to the University of Puerto Rico campus in Rio Piedras to put down an Independista rally. "Chingada! Hijos de la chingada!" she had screamed as she climbed the back of a policeman who was busily clubbing her boyfriend. She drew a crowd, a mob, an army. She was 19 and had multiple fractures of the skull, a broken arm, broken ribs, a dislocated hip, and a ruptured spleen. She was 19 and would not live to tell about it. It was 1967. Puerto Ricans were drafted to fight in Vietnam but could not vote for president. Roads in El Yunque were blocked when the U.S. Army did exercises, chunk, chunk of artillery, helicopters overhead. Ghosts of Puerto Rico's Independista dream returned, the cry of Laris, Lolita, LeBron. It would never be silenced. Chingada, hijos de la chingada. I would always hear it. All of a sudden, a peristaltic gurgling in my stomach, trapped gas, a persistent ache, as if a hole had been dug out, an incipient ulcer, always threatening. Elisabetta waits patiently, one hand still on a hip, following someone she has seen go down the street. "Dulce Estejuden?" she asks. "Another coffee?" For a moment, she picks self-consciously at the pimple on her nose, her glance over my shoulder. I needed caffeine. I could never get enough caffeine to kickstart the morning, keep the afternoon from collapse, hold off sleep. I nod. "Ano." "Yes." "No milk." "Mileko," she says. Down the street, a tall blonde looks at something in a store window. Her straw blonde hair is tied back in a ponytail, and she's wearing a man's white shirt with the cuffs rolled up, black tights. Suddenly, she looks up at something that has caught her attention. The cry of a bird, a workman on a roof, her gaze fixed on something I can't see. Broadly, she smiles, delighted. As if the past I put behind me had been packed in my luggage. It could not be Solveig, but for a moment she was there, as she had not been when she was. She was 18 when she got married and was a 40-year-old woman who had become 18 for a second time after her divorce. I was not the man she would marry, but the one she needed to prove to herself that she was desirable. A middle-aged couple stops to consult a map of the old town. A girl puts an arm around a boy and looks at him with a possessive smile. Another couple with a young boy who is angry about something. In a moment, the middle-aged woman points down the street. But before she and her husband move on, they stop a tall woman in a silk paisley dress whose breast bounced as she walked. Nedrozumiem po slovensky, she says. We don't speak Slovak. What did she say, she asks after the tall woman has gone down the street. I catch myself carrying on endless, pointless conversations in my head in the third person. Rehearsals for a future that will not come. Recapitulations of a past I could do nothing about. Nedrozumiem, always nedrozumiem. Yesterday, an American asked me if I spoke English. My only answer had been a no that led back only to itself. After Vietnam, the murders of King, the Kennedys, and Malcolm, Nixon, the sour years of Reagan, the Bushes, Iraq. We put an ear to the tracks. We saw the future. The train came round the bend, and there was no mistaking the engineer. It has not ceased to come through. If you sit at their table, you break their bread. If you look around, they are watching. If you say something, those spit out, broken down, given up, come back inside. When I got off the bus in Bratislava, I could barely lift my luggage. The straps of the backpack cut deeply into my shoulder. The first day in the apartment, I lay on the couch, dully gazing at the ceiling, my body aching, an exhaustion so extreme it shut everything else out. I got lost wherever I went the first week, even when I took along a map. I would find myself on the same street I left 15 minutes before and not know how I got back or even know I had been there. On one corner, a street sign would give one street name, and across the street, another. I would find the name of the first street, five blocks down, the same street. Light of the full moon, spectral, burnished. Stars bright in the night sky when I made my way home. Outside, a couple talks quietly. The last cafe closed an hour ago. In the distance, the rising and falling shriek of an ambulance, the faint, high-pitched whistle of a locomotive. In another hour, trucks from the countryside will make their way down the street to markets, the deep, monotone hoot of an owl, the faint, luminous, silver reflection of the TV, a ghostly presence. I lay sprawled on the couch. For a moment, I rub my right shoulder, which is stiff and has ached for months. Something in the shoulder clicked when I raised my arm above my head. When I got up this morning, my back had been stiff, and it took me the better part of a walk to loosen it. Five empty Zloty Blazhants on the floor. Dead soldiers in the battle I fight with myself. I needed alcohol to stir me as much as to shut me down. The beer does its job until its job is done. Some evenings everything evens out. Some evenings I did not care. Suddenly my stomach spasms and the sour hops and barley of beer rushes up my esophagus. I wrap blanket around me, tuck my chin down on my breast, watch the movie on TV. Wong Kar-wai's 2046. Tony Leung watches Zi Yi Zhang, follows her, waits. He enters restaurants after her, sits across the room from her. He stops her in the hall and asks questions. He stands outside her door, listening to her make love. The number of the room is 2046, and he has rented the room next to it because the woman he loved years ago lived there, and he cannot forget her, as if the moment of 2046 will never end. Her hand on my shoulder. Slowly, her fingers caress my neck, pause to trace the outline of my chin, the stubble of my unshaven face. Her touch, a whisper in the night. The tightness in my back eases. Hannah's bed in college was little more than a cot. I woke mornings after a night with her with a stiff back, and when I got up, my back would spasm. I stretch my legs out in front of me, run a hand down a thigh, briefly touch myself. The sing-song lilting of Chinese from the TV, tick, tick of the clock. Suddenly, the hoot of an owl. In a moment, I will turn and see Hannah's smile, gleaming white teeth, cardinal red lips, pale blue cobalt eyes. In a moment, I will press my lips against hers. It must have been 3-4 a.m. when we had come out of a bar in Kent. Last call, long given. We had lingered over our last drink, not wanting to leave. Graduation was 2 weeks off. We had reached the end of something, a beginning that was uncertain, and started drinking hard at 8 or 9 o'clock and did not stop. "I don't give a fuck," Hannah kept saying. "It's not the beginning, it's the end. A life in the suburbs, children whose shit you have to clean, a husband who cheats on you with his secretary." The more we drank, the more sober we became. Outside the bar, Hannah looked down the street for a moment in the direction of the town, and then up the street towards the campus, walked out to the middle of the road, glanced down at the center line. The lights from campus, a beacon on the hill. For a moment, she looked at me in a way I did not understand. Before she lay down, unbuttoned her Levi's, shucked them off, pulled up her T-shirt. "Fuck me, Benchik. God, fuck me." Her breasts glistened under the streetlight, and her dark red nipples were swollen. Tony Ling lies on his bed. Smokes, thinks about the past. He has a memory of a first love so perfect that nothing else can be the same. Night after night, he goes to bars and clubs in search of love. Some nights he brings a woman to his room, but she is never the one. Some nights he cannot sleep, and at his desk writes of women he has glimpsed across a club or down a street, women he has brought back to his room, the woman he has lost, always the one he has lost. What he writes is so erotic, so powerful, he cannot sleep nights. We eat memory as if it will keep us young. Steps down the hall, pausing as if someone has forgotten something, is uncertain what to do next. Slowing as if tired, perhaps drunk, stopping outside the door. I wait for the knock. A voice asks if I'm there. I imagine the slow intake of breath, a sigh. In a moment, the steps continue down the hall, fading. In Detroit, they did not knock. A federal agent, a state narc, and a Detroit detective came into the apartment in an orderly way and spread out across the room. One had a gun. They knew we had drugs. They knew everyone at the university had drugs. But it was less about drugs than politics. That afternoon, a city councilwoman announced a press conference documenting police corruption with mafia. That evening, the police hit the school. The university was a hotbed of sex, drugs, rock and roll, radicalism. They knew who we were. To save us from ourselves, they would save themselves. A student I saw in jail had been waiting for a bus after his classes. 76 had been arrested, but only one charged for a single joint. It was front page news. The press conference of the councilwoman was in agate type in the back pages. The first time Hannah and I made love, I had come out of the bathroom afterward, and not knowing what I would say, said that this was not plain. I wanted us to risk something together. That there was too much compromise in life, too much sacrifice of love to comfort, and I was sick of it. Hannah sat on a chair with one leg lifted, her foot on the seat of the chair, her chin resting on a knee, and looked at me as if I did not understand anything. We eat memory as if it will ease our days. They come unbidden in the middle of the night, unceasing, a drumbeat like rain on a roof that never stops. A girl sobbing and holding a boy whose head was split by police when they broke up a rally in Morningside Heights. A morning choked, convulsive. That's the morning for death. On and on and on. After seeing all these Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in the East Village, Hannah turned to me outside the theater and waited for me to say something. I looked away, ran a hand down my thigh. I knew she would walk away if I did nothing. For weeks, we had circled around it. "Listen," I said, "I can't do what I want to do, but I can't let it go." I take a sip of the last latte and for a moment rub my forehead to ease the headache that has developed in the last few minutes. I never thought I would walk away from Hannah one fine summer morning, absolutely certain I had to do what I had to do, though my whole body rebelled against it. I stretched a hand out in front of me, clenched it into a fist, and in a moment, let the hand fall. When I heard her husky, full voice say, "Hello, hello," excited, as if she were expecting a call, I could not say anything. I did not know why I had called. Just knew that when I heard her voice, I would know. Her voice silenced me. As if I understood for the first time, it was over. For a moment, I waited. "It's you, isn't it?" Hannah said at last. "It's you." Her voice in my mouth. I waited a moment longer before I hung up. Zhang tells Ling she wants him back, but he says no. It is not possible. No one who enters 2046 ever returns. Thank you.